controversy in the open source community? Impossible. Well, yeah, it's a, here's another one. You know, we've seen little bits of controversy here and there over the years with anything related to open source projects, right? Usually it's somebody who was caught taking open source and turning it into a product and selling it when the license agreement says they weren't allowed to do that, that sort of thing. Now we've gotten kind of a bigger one brewing in the Linux community again, in a way. Let's back up and then we'll put all this in perspective. It revolves around Red Hat Linux. If you're a Linux expert, you can probably skip ahead a bit on this one, but you may know that there's many forms of Linux out there, right? There isn't just one Linux OS like there is one Mac OS or one Windows OS, right? It's this big thing, and because it's open source, it's free for anyone to go and kind of tweak it however they want, right? So there's just tons of different distributions out there. There are two really big ones, Debian and Fedora. And Fedora is managed by a company called Red Hat. And Red Hat has a really interesting structure to the way it deals with Linux. Basically, Red Hat is a company, a for-profit company, and their software engineers go and take the Linux kernel, which is open source, and a whole bunch of other software packages, which are open source, and put it all together into various different versions of Linux. The two that Red Hat themselves manage, the upstream one, the so-called upstream one, is called Fedora. And that's where they do kind of all the cutting edge work, all the latest and greatest, the brand new stuff. They're still trying to kind of figure out where they want to go with the OS. So it's a little bit in flux, and sometimes software packages that they release, you know, don't fully work right, or maybe they change their mind about how they want to do something and, you know, roll it back or whatever, right? It can be a little buggy. So generally, only if you want to be like right on that bleeding edge of features and functionality would you run Fedora. Big companies don't like doing that, right? So if you're a big company and you need to run Linux for your servers, you aren't likely going to run Fedora just because there's too much risk that a new update would like break all of your everything. So what those companies do, and where Red Hat the company makes all of its money, is through Red Hat Enterprise Linux, RHEL. And that's like the mainstream release, right? You pay for that. And when you pay for it as a customer, you get support and you also get kind of a guarantee, a promise, whatever, somewhere in the middle, that you're going to be getting a very stable version of Linux, right? All of the, you know, major bugs, all the major feature changes, all that kind of stuff has really been kind of baked in. They've been dealt with. It's a very smooth platform to be on, and companies like that sort of thing, right? The releases come at a very kind of regular pace, and you get support for old releases, you know, for some period of time. So as soon as the new one comes out, you don't have to immediately upgrade everything to it in order to stay in support. You know, they'll support older releases. They'll still come out with, you know, bug fixes and security updates and everything for certain older releases. You can open support cases, that sort of thing. So Red Hat Enterprise Linux has been a very popular choice for companies when they need that stability, but they don't necessarily have people on staff who are programmers for the OS. If you're a huge company like Amazon or Google or Facebook, you're probably going to be running a free version of Linux because you're big enough where it's actually cheaper for you to hire engineers to deal with all of those bugs and write patches and fix all that kind of stuff in-house than it is the cost of a support contract for that many copies of Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Depending on how many licenses you need, it can be thousands of dollars a year for, you know, even just kind of a medium-sized company to be able to get support. But if you are one of those medium-sized companies, which is often the case, and that's actually where, you know, I sit, I run Red Hat at work, it can be a very, very good option. Lots of software supports it. So if you're using some sort of software stack, application stack that needs Linux, very, very likely it'll say it works with Red Hat, you know, and so that's the supported path forward. There's the upstream, which was Fedora. There's kind of that mainstream enterprise release, which is Red Hat Enterprise Linux. But then there's also what they call the downstream releases. And because of the way that open source licensing works, especially around Linux, in general, even though you have to pay for Red Hat Linux proper, the company Red Hat still has to make all of the work that it does freely available. So that basically means, you know, they have to publish all that source code. That doesn't mean they have to give away Red Hat Enterprise Linux, but that means they have to make all the source code for it available. And so for the longest time, they've done that. And what happens is then the community, Linux community, open source community, will pick up all that source and basically kind of recompile it into their own versions. And for the longest time, that downstream release was called CentOS or CentOS. And so that served kind of another set of customers, if you will, where let's say you're a smaller organization, you don't have the money to be able to afford the Red Hat licensing and support, but you still need that stability, especially since you are a small organization. You just don't have the people power to be able to chase bugs all the time, right? So you have that need, but you don't have the money. CentOS was really kind of the best option for you. You didn't get any sort of paid support with it. It was completely freely available, but the idea was since it's made from the same code that goes into that stable Red Hat Enterprise Linux release, you're getting that same quasi-promise of stability, but without the cost. Anyone could go and freely download it. And what's interesting is a lot of companies that produce products that run Linux will actually use or have used CentOS as the base for their product because it doesn't cost anything. So think things like network switches or purpose-built servers, that kind of stuff. You know, if you're a company that writes your own kind of special sauce software that sits on top that performs a certain function, but you need an operating system for that to run on because you want to sell a complete package and not just your special software, a lot of times those companies have gone with CentOS just because it doesn't cost them any money to use. Now, a few years ago, Red Hat made a change. And the relationship between Red Hat, the company, and CentOS has always been really kind of interesting, where the longest time, Red Hat kind of owned, in quotes, CentOS, and its engineers would actually push updates to CentOS as bugs and security problems were found. So it wasn't necessarily a Red Hat just releases the source code, and now the community is fully responsible for turning it into CentOS. Red Hat, the company, has always had involvement in CentOS, making that available, building it, you know, that sort of thing. You couldn't call up Red Hat and ask for support. I mean, unless you, you know, maybe paid for an enterprise Linux contract or something like that. But because it was attached to Red Hat, the company, they had a level of responsibility to, you know, make CentOS stable and kind of fulfill its promise, right? Well, a few years ago, Red Hat got bought by IBM. It used to be a standalone company. And IBM, of course, does the whole thing where it's like, oh, we're not going to change anything. You know, we're going to run it as a separate company, blah, blah, blah. It's the same thing that every company says when they acquire another one, right? Oh, don't worry, we're not going to change anything. And that's always BS. But after the IBM acquisition, they then decided we're going to change where CentOS sits in the landscape. And instead of having CentOS be this downstream thing from Red Hat Enterprise Linux, they moved it so that it basically kind of sits underneath Fedora, that upstream release. Remember the kind of cutting edge, latest, greatest, but potentially buggy sort of thing. And they call it CentOS Stream now. Stream, I guess, is their term for, you know, upstream, kind of the buggy stuff. And they came out with a bunch of BS, kind of marketing mumbo jumbo as to why they were doing it, blah, blah, blah. Needless to say, the community freaked out because now you're cutting out that entire group of people who were in the position of needing CentOS, right? They needed that stability, but they didn't have the money, or they were a company trying to build a product and they were trying to get off the ground and they just couldn't afford to cut a deal with Red Hat to run their product on enterprise Linux. It would kill their margin, or maybe they were still in a startup phase or whatever. They just didn't have the money. So now CentOS is moving up to the upstream, and that's not really a viable option for a lot of people. So, okay, the community bands together. Red Hat is still publishing all the source code for enterprise Linux because they have to as part of the, you know, the open source licensing agreements. So they then go, and these various communities go and build their own versions to kind of replace CentOS where it was in that downstream kind of release. And of course, the Linux diehards listening to this are probably banging their heads against their desk because I'm generalizing this very high level. It's a much more intricate issue than it is, but we'd be here all day if I didn't. So we ended up with two new downstream releases called Rocky Linux and Alma Linux. And basically what those groups do is they just take those sources from Red Hat Enterprise Linux and just turn them into their own OSs. So now there's kind of this detachment from Red Hat, the company, right? Red Hat isn't directly contributing to those two new OSs, but they serve to fulfill that need. And, you know, if you are a company that can't really pay a ton, but you still need some support, there's ways where you can hire people to help provide support kind of as a more ad hoc kind of basis, right? There isn't a huge ton of structure behind Rocky or Alma Linux. You know, there's not really a company you can call up and, you know, talk to someone and, you know, they are, you know, Rocky Incorporated or whatever. It's like, it's a lot more kind of loosey-goosey, but it fulfills that need. So for the last few years, those two distributions have been gaining steam, gaining followers. I've actually kicked around Rocky Linux. I like it. You know, it works fine. It seems to really kind of, you know, pick up where CentOS left off in that downstream distribution kind of space. Well, very recently, Red Hat decided that wasn't acceptable anymore either. And they came out with this big blog post that used a bunch of weasel words or whatever, but more or less, Red Hat's position is that if you aren't paying Red Hat for an enterprise license because you need that stability, then you're just a freeloader. Freeloader is the word that I keep seeing bantered about around this issue as, you know, being kind of the term that Red Hat is leaning towards, right? So what Red Hat's doing is they're locking away the source code behind not necessarily a paywall. Well, they are, and that's where one of the big questions is, but they're not making it as freely available as it was before. Now you need to have a developer account in order to get in and get access to that source code. And they've added limitations to the clauses, you know, the terms and conditions and all that about like what you can do with that source code and how you can distribute it and blah, 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 blah. It used to be where basically you could just go and get it. And now they're making it harder to get and making it very clear in the language of the terms and conditions that you can't take that source code if you have an account and just freely give it away to anybody else. So it's going to be a real test to see if anybody starts, like, you know, getting a Red Hat developer account, grabbing all that source code, and then turning around and building, you know, a Rocky Linux clone or whatever, using it to see what Red Hat, the company, does. The thing that I think is going to get Red Hat in hot water is potentially a lot of the language that they use, the terms and conditions. Some of what they're actually doing is not necessarily against the licensing agreement, you know, that open source, you know, the GPL that Linux really kind of falls under. But the big thing is going to be who's going to challenge them in court if it comes to that, right? Red Hat is backed by IBM. IBM has definitely been knocked down a few pegs in the last couple of decades. They are no longer the giant behemoth that they once were in the computing landscape, but they're still pretty big and they still have a lot of money. So who's going to go after them? That's going to be a very costly affair in terms of a lawsuit. Because what Red Hat is doing is not a crime. It's not a criminal sort of thing. It's a civil thing. It's breach of contract if anyone, you know, were to challenge them in a court of law. And so that becomes a civil matter. And so now you've just got tons of lawyers involved and it just gets very expensive. And I think that's what IBM is really kind of banking on. Now, my gut is telling me that this is really kind of coming from the IBM side and not so much the Red Hat side. I think IBM is seeing, you know, because it's publicly traded and all that, you know, they're trying to do the whole, well, we need to get as much value for our stockholders as we can, kind of blah, blah, blah. And I've railed on about that in the past. But I think they're also kind of looking long term at IBM's own future. And IBM doesn't, without Red Hat, IBM doesn't really have a huge future, right? It's got a dwindling product portfolio. It doesn't produce hardware anymore. So it's kind of a software and services company, but IBM's old mainstays of software that people used, Lotus Notes and Domino and DB2 and all this kind of stuff, those are falling away. Nobody uses those anymore. So, and that's arguably why IBM bought Red Hat to begin with, because Red Hat makes, you know, a decent amount of money. There has been some debate about, you know, if there was going to be a lawsuit, and this would be really entertaining, that it would actually come from Oracle. Because one of the interesting little twists here is that Oracle has actually been one of the places that's taken that Red Hat Enterprise Linux source code and turned it into their own OS. So we had CentOS all along, and it's free. It was free. It still is. CentOS Stream is. But if you wanted a paid solution, but you didn't want to pay Red Hat directly, you could buy Oracle Linux. And it was cheaper, believe it or not, being an Oracle product. It was cheaper than a support contract from Red Hat. The problem is you're dealing with Oracle. And if you're a seasoned IT expert, you know you just don't want to deal with Oracle. They're a horrible company to deal with. Their license agreements are just insane. And the way that they price their products and enforce licensing and all that, they're a horrible company to deal with. A few years ago, I had it proposed to me like, hey, Colin, we could save, you know, some money if we switch from Red Hat to Oracle. And I'm like, hell no. No, we're not doing that, because we already have a few Oracle database instances that, you know, we're paying arguably way too much for compared to what, you know, value we get out of it. And dealing with all their arcane requirements for the licensing and blah, blah, blah is just stupid. So, you know, if you were crazy or whatever, you could buy Oracle Linux. And the whole deal there is they're the ones that maintain that. So if you have a problem, even though it's really based on Red Hat Enterprise Linux, and you have a paid support contract, you're calling up Oracle. And it becomes Oracle's responsibility to fix that in whatever way they decide, right? So if you find a bug or whatever, they would be the ones who have to arrange to get a patch written or figure out if a patch is coming and reproduce the problem and all that sort of thing. So there was a paid non-Red Hat solution out there. Well, that's going to cut Oracle off. At least what a lot of people think will happen is it's going to cut Oracle off. And so they may get pissed and take IBM to court. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. As much as we would all love to see like Oracle versus IBM duke it out in a court of law, because that would be pretty amusing, because there's a lot of people who don't like IBM either. I really don't think it's going to happen. What probably will happen, if it hasn't already, and this is still kind of a fast moving story, so if you're listening to this one sometime after it got published, the story has probably changed considerably since when I recorded it. But what's likely going to happen is Oracle is simply going to cut a deal with IBM, right? IBM knows that eroding its installed base too much would be detrimental, right? Like, you can't piss off the community too much, because that'll just kill your company. You've got to push as far as you can to make money, because that's just the way every company works. But there is that point where you have to stop. And I think IBM is even smart enough to realize that if they piss off Oracle and Oracle decides, okay, fine, screw you, we're just going to do something else, even though Red Hat doesn't directly benefit monetarily right now from Oracle Linux, if Oracle switches and says, you know what, we're just going to move to Debian or something else, or we'll drop the product or whatever, well, suddenly now the effective installed base for Red Hat shrinks. And so that's a problem, because now software developers are going to have less incentive to officially support that. So the companies that produce enterprise software, they say, okay, this is, you know, the platform that we certify to run on because this is what we test it with. And, you know, if you're running this version of Red Hat, we guarantee our product will run on top of it, that sort of thing. What'll happen ultimately is Oracle is probably going to strike some kind of license agreement with IBM. Oracle will probably pay IBM some amount of money, but it won't be enough to really affect Oracle Linux as a platform. It'll probably give Oracle an excuse to increase license prices for its customers for Oracle Linux, but it won't be so much that you'd be better off just buying Red Hat licenses instead, right? It'll be a little bit of horse trading in the end, and that's kind of it. Sad to say. Now, outside Red Hat, because, I mean, Red Hat does do a lot of development itself. It's a major contributor to the Linux ecosystem, and I don't think anyone would argue that. But at the same time, just because of the way Linux works, obviously Red Hat is going to be using code and packages and software that other people have written outside of Red Hat. And they're just going to take that and they use it, you know, for free, because maybe there's, you know, groups of people out there who just do that as their hobby, right? They manage this little part of the Linux, you know, the Linux ecosystem, this particular process or whatever, and that's something that Red Hat needs to include in the OS, so they just grab it and include it. So that's really been kind of the crux of the controversy, is Red Hat is killing the downstream free releases because they want people to pay Red Hat instead. But Red Hat is profiting off of the work that other people are doing for free, but not fulfilling its end of the bargain with open source and making open source freely available. And that all got me thinking. A few weeks ago, if you're into 3D printing at all, you may watch Thomas Sandletter's channel. He does a fantastic job talking about 3D printing and not just the nuts and bolts of it, but kind of the ecosystem, right? He'll occasionally take a step back and talk about like the state of 3D printing and where the industry is going and that sort of thing. A few weeks ago, he dropped a really interesting video where the premise of it was basically, in 3D printing, open source has failed. The whole concept of open source as it relates to the 3D printing industry is non-sustainable. And he went to explain that what happens is, you know, you've got either hobbyists or these startup companies that develop new technologies and open source it for the benefit of the community. And then you've got these other companies that are startups that take that open source and use it as the foundation for their product and then just profit off of it without really giving anything back to the community, right? So a great example of kind of one of those former companies is Prusa. I'm a big fan of Prusa as a company and also their products. What Prusa Research does generally is they'll do kind of like what Red Hat does. They're kind of in the middle where there's some upstream stuff going on that's open source that they'll take because, hey, why reinvent the wheel? But then they also have paid staff that then go and augment it. They fix bugs, they improve on it, they add new features, they bolt on additional functionality, turn it into a product that they then sell. But they also make a lot of that, what they do, open source. So a great example, very specific, and this is actually in the software realm, is the software that you use with Prusa's printers called Prusa Slicer. The idea is you take your 3D model, you drop it into Prusa Slicer, and it generates the file that you then copy to the printer so the printer knows how to print what you want it to make. Prusa Slicer is based on an open source project called Slick3R. Now, Prusa Slicer is something that Prusa, the company, goes, spends, you know, paid employees time to work on and improve, add new features. It's not just putting a new skin on top of Slick3R. Prusa Slicer has a lot more functionality. It's a lot more polished. And it sees ongoing development. Like, Prusa didn't just do it once and then leave it to die on the vine. Like, there are new releases on a regular basis for Prusa Slicer. And the thing is, Prusa Slicer doesn't just work with Prusa's printers. You can generate files that work with a lot of different printers. It's actually very flexible. You can tweak all the different settings, so you're not just locked into presets that only work with their hardware. And so because of that, and the fact that Prusa Slicer is open source, a lot of other 3D companies, you know, printer manufacturers, have people just use Prusa Slicer. Because, again, why reinvent the wheel, right? Those companies will maybe just, like, advertise the presets that you should use, or here's the settings to put into Prusa Slicer to make the files that it generates work the best with our hardware. And they rely on Prusa Slicer to just keep maintaining that software. So that's actually a very good kind of analogy in the 3D printing world about what's been going on with Red Hat. The thing is, it's not just Prusa Slicer, right? Like, Prusa Slicer is free, and you can download it for free, and you can get the source code, and you can do whatever you want with it. But it's only one piece of the entire picture, right? Ultimately, 3D printing is about hardware. Well, Red Hat doesn't sell hardware. Red Hat is just the software piece. So what Thomas in his video was kind of getting at is, yeah, okay, there's the software side of it, and that's fine, but the software is just the means to an end. The end is the actual hardware. And there is such a thing as open source hardware as well, where instead of it necessarily being code, the hardware is like the physical design. Like, here's CAD files about how you produce a thing. Here's the electrical schematics and that sort of stuff, right? And Prusa's been doing that too. Like, if you wanted, you could build your own clone of a Prusa printer just from open source without giving them a dime. Thomas's argument has been that we're getting to a point in the 3D printing world where there's enough companies that basically just do that, that build either clones of other companies' printers based on the open source, you know, materials that have been made available, or base their products on the open source, but don't give back. They don't make any meaningful changes to it, because that's really kind of the point behind open source, is if you're just an end consumer and you're using it for free, that's fine because you are the end consumer. But the gist is, if you sit somewhere in the middle where you take an open source project and you modify it to your needs, or you use it as the basis for your own product and then turn around and sell that product, you really should be recontributing back to the open source ecosystem by giving away the changes that you've made. And I think the failure really is there's too many companies kind of at the end behaving like they're an end consumer, but they're really not, and fewer companies there sitting in the middle that are really kind of feeding the entire thing. So those companies sitting in the middle are seeing profits erode because competitors can produce their products, effectively their products, for less money. So consumers are going to go and buy the cheaper thing, right? Like, if you could buy a genuine Prusa printer for $500, or you could buy a clone that ostensibly does the same thing for $300, you'd probably go buy the clone. I mean, it's the exact same thing that we saw like in the 80s and 90s when IBM clones started coming out, right? Why would you, if it does effectively the same thing, why would you pay IBM the price premium for its hardware when you could just buy somebody else's hardware that does basically the same thing? Now, their support may not be as good, and it may take time to get bugs fixed because you aren't getting the fix directly from the source, right? You have to wait, that sort of thing. But for a lot of people, the cost savings is worth the risk. And that's been the case with CentOS, or in this case now, Rocky and Alma Linux, is it's stable enough, you get what you pay for, they're free, but it's 99% of what you would get out of Red Hat. So the argument with 3D printing is that open source has generally failed just because it's become so lopsided. There are way too few people contributing and too many companies consuming and not giving back. And so the path forward for that industry is basically to move away from open source, to embrace patents in order to promise the company's survival because they get to keep the technology for themselves. And, you know, that's a premise that a lot of open source fanatics are just going to lose their minds about. And Thomas, in his video, and I've linked it in the description of this podcast episode, if you want to go watch it, and I recommend you do. He even went into his episode saying, you know, I went into this thinking I was going to be like just doing a devil's advocate kind of a thing. But as he was writing the script and doing research, he kind of came to realize it makes sense. You know, why should you continue to enable the freeloaders, for lack of a better term, at the expense of your own company when you could keep that for yourself? Use the money that you earn to reinvest in your own company to make your company even better. And then because you get to keep the technology to yourself, because it's locked away by a patent, that then would spur competition, right? So instead of everyone using the same source code to base their 3D printers on, and it just being a whole sea of clones that are all pretty much the same thing, and the only thing that differentiates them is maybe the quality of the materials they're made out of and, you know, how fly-by-night the company that produced them may be. Instead, it's going to promote a more robust and healthy ecosystem by forcing those kind of bottom feeders to drop out and the more healthy companies who want to actually, you know, become the best they can be, not just make a quick buck, you know, get them to really compete, because competition is always good. And that makes actually a lot of sense. As much as I like open source, you know, at the end of the day, as a consumer, you need to get a quality product, because nobody likes using cheap junk that breaks all the time, right? Like, you know, if you're a sysadmin for a company, you aren't going to tolerate having servers that are super buggy and crashing all the time and all that, right? That's a waste of your time. No matter how much money your company saves, you eventually get to a point where you're spending more on your employees' time trying to fix problems than you would just buying the better product. And that's kind of been the whole promise of, you know, Red Hat Enterprise Linux anyway. And that also applies to 3D printing, right? Like, ultimately, you get to a point where if your 3D printer is just failing all the time, you're spending more time trying to fix it and troubleshoot it than you are actually printing things with it. Now, for some people, that's fine because it's a hobby and they actually enjoy the hobby of 3D printing, tinkering with the printer. It becomes a hobby in itself. But other people, like myself, just use it as a tool. I really couldn't care less about, you know, the nuts and bolts of the product itself. I don't necessarily care how the printer itself is engineered and all the different parts that it uses. I just want a tool that's going to be safe and reliable and not really force me to spend more time using it than I have to. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if your car is unreliable, you just need to get to work. You just need to get to the grocery store. You just need to go where you need to go. You need the tool to just stop being this basket case and just do its job. So, you know, what's going on with Red Hat kind of is, I think, maybe an indication of where things might be going just with open source in general. Is open source as a concept has been around for long enough now that free spirit mentality it started with has really started to erode. And is that still alive and well? To some extent, yes, because there are plenty of people out there who are creating really awesome things and making them open source. But what I've noticed is that it feels like those are more and more kind of niche, purpose-built things and not so much larger encompassing things, right? You don't see so many people coming out with, a full-on database stack, right? Like, we've got MySQL and MariaDB and that kind of stuff. We don't see brand new ones really coming out that are big, that are going to upset the status quo. What I feel like we've been seeing more and more of lately are these little niche things, right? Like, for example, Mini VMac from one of my recent videos. You know, that little Macintosh emulator that's, you know, it's open source and you can recompile it to, you know, run on whatever platform you want. That's not going to change the world, that little thing. We've been seeing fewer and fewer kind of world-changing developments in open source, brand new big things. It's all a whole bunch of little things. I think that's where open source is probably going to continue to trend as time goes on. The big question is, what's going to happen to all the big things that are already open source, right? What's going to happen to Fedora and that entire stack? What's going to happen to Debian and that entire stack? Linux is only one part of open source, of course, right? There's the whole BSD thing, right? So as all of this Red Hat stuff has been churning, FreeBSD, NetBSD, OpenBSD, all of them are just kind of sitting on the sidelines going, oh, that's funny. You know, because they've got their own thing going on, the whole Unix and BSD side. You know, it's not just Linux. Linux isn't just the open source, you know, the only open source stuff going on. How is all of this going to shake out as we potentially move towards a more lockdown kind of model, a more paid model? You know, that gulf, I feel like, is just going to get wider between if you want something that's supported and reliable and all of that, but paid, and something that's free, but free, you know? I don't know ultimately how this is going to end up as I'm recording this. You know, who knows? Maybe the backlash against Red Hat will get strong enough where they'll change their mind, at least for a while. I guarantee you, if they do change their mind, they'll revisit the topic in a few years as people have kind of, you know, cleaned it from their mind and forgotten about the details, and they'll kind of try and sneaky do it again, because that's just the way it is. Once a company plays its hand as to the way it wants to go, that's the way it's going to go. And they may not have gotten away with it at first, but within a few years, they're going to try it again, and they'll probably be more sneaky about it, and they'll get their way. So no matter how this turns out with Red Hat Enterprise Linux and downstream and all of that, you know that's the path Red Hat is going to go down. So is that going to affect its customers? Honestly, probably not. I don't think anybody running Red Hat Enterprise Linux and paying for a support contract and all of that, I don't think they're going to care, because it's their employer's money. It's not their own money. They've bought Enterprise Linux, you know, from Red Hat for probably years now anyway. And honestly, as much as I really value open source and the contributions and just kind of the moral obligations that come along with it, I don't really have any plans to change where my organization sits in terms of the enterprise, you know, Linux distribution of choice. We're not going to switch to anything else simply because it's going to be too much effort to switch, and the loss of guaranteed compatibility with the software that we use. Sad to say, that's just the way it is. And I have to make a business decision along those lines. I wish I could let more ethics and morals kind of dictate the way that it works. But I can't, because ultimately, I've got a job to do. And I'm pretty sure that's what Red Hat is banking on. As always, thanks for listening.